For as important as machine learning and Kafka are as separate technology trends right now, I'm still surprised when I see them together. But you know, I shouldn't be. Today, I talked to Chris Mattman, author of Machine Learning with TensorFlow, about machine learning in general and how it fits in with Kafka and the broader world of event streaming. You may notice some microphone rustling in the first few minutes, but stick with us. It gets better. Regardless of that, I learned a lot on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am, as always, your host, Tim Berglund, and I'm joined in the virtual studio today by my guest, Chris Mattman. Chris is a lot of things, but one of those things is he's the author of Machine Learning with TensorFlow 2nd Edition, which is in the Manning Early Access Program, or MEEP. But if I said Machine Learning with TensorFlow 2nd Edition, MEEP, you didn't know what MEEP meant, that would sound weird. But that is what Chris is doing, and he is here on the show today to talk to us about TensorFlow and eventually, of course, make some connections between it and Kafka. Chris, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks so much. I really appreciate you having me, Tim.
You bet. I said the book and the topic and all that, but I'm always interested to know your background. You know, what are you doing now? How'd you get to do that? How did you get into machine learning? Tell us about you.
I'll try and spare your audience, my wife's comment about me being long-winded and get to the point.
I have never heard that about myself. I don't know what that's like to be accused of that, but maybe you can tell me.
Let me fast forward. I grew up in Southern California. I'll just say I'm, deeply affected by Kobe Bryant's death. Many of us who grew up here are. I grew up in a town about an hour north of LA called Santa Clarita. Basically, the way I would describe it to people is it's where Magic Mountain is if you're on the West Coast, or a Six Flags theme park. That's basically what we were known for growing up. And I went from there to the University of Southern California. I studied computer science there. While I was there, I picked up a gig basically to try and make money because I was poor. I grew up in a mobile home. I like to tell people, my story is from the trailer to the PhD, while I was at SC, I got a job at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is one of the 9 NASA centers. And it's a special NASA center because it's what we call, it's one of the national labs. We call it a federally funded research and development center, or an FFRDC. JPL and NASA are a center of excellence. And JPL in particular is a center of excellence in robotic and autonomous exploration. So people say, oh, you work at JPL. Oh, it's so awesome. Are you working, with Elon and stuff like that on the commercial? So actually, we have some areas there, but most of the work that the way I reply is, hey, have you seen the robots that land on Mars? We do that. So the Mars program is at JPL. We do a lot of Earth science remote sensing. So yeah, so I got a job there almost 20 years ago. I can't believe it. I feel old. But I've been working there since I was a pup. While I was finishing my master's, I ended up getting a PhD at USC. I just kept working at JPL. I ended up leading teams of people that built and it's great that this podcast is about Kafka and big data and other things and streaming, because really the revolution that was happening kind of in the mid-2000s, the 2010s and things like that, I was part of it. So I was one of the people who created Hadoop. While I was at JPL, I got a lot really involved in open source software. While I was getting my PhD, I was doing that. I was basically trying to convince the older generation at JPL, we could do instrument science and ground data systems using Java, And so the big challenge there was, of course, they all wanted to do it in C and C++, and they believed that Java sucked and things like that. And so that was a difficult conversation. But at the end of the day, we won. We convinced them to do it. We did 3 Earth Science flagship missions that moved us into the big data era with Java, with, technologies like Hadoop, with data processing, machine learning, and all of that. Those missions were the Orbiting Carbon Observatory, measure CO2 from space, the UNPOS Preparatory Project, the National Polar Orbiting Satellites, and a recent one called SMAP, Soil Moisture Active Passive. So I helped lead teams, put together the teams that did that. I moved into technology development after that, basically figuring out all the things that we did wrong, creating missions and how we could do them better. Got really involved. I got on the board of the Apache Software Foundation, which will probably make sense to your listeners if they are interested in Kafka, because Kafka is an Apache project. And so I was on the board of Apache from 2013 to 2018, promoting that at NASA, JPL, and everywhere else. In the last few years, I've moved over into the Information Technology Directorate. I'm in IT now. I'm the deputy CTO. I lead a team of about 40 innovators that are working in all sorts of things, you know, from big data analytics to machine learning. And like you and I were kind of discussing kind of offline, you know, and things like that. Basically, I got tired the last few years of hearing all the people in my team talk about, you know, matrix algebra and math and things like that, and all the amazing things that like deep learning and machine learning were doing. And so as a former Manning author, about 10 years ago, I wrote the book Tika in Action. I was the creator of Apache Tika, which was one of the all the other projects that got spun out of Hadoop and things like that and Nutch. As a former Manning author, I still, you know, pay attention to kind of the lineage and pedagogy of books, and I get the books and all that. And so I got a book, a first edition of a book called Machine Learning with TensorFlow, written by a guy named Nishant Shukla, who's an amazing recent PhD grad from UCLA in computer vision. And it was great. I picked it up and I couldn't put it down. One of the things about that book were that Nishant, being sort of an academic, everywhere where he's teaching you about things like regression and things like that, he's like, oh, and I just taught you regression, and now go grab this open data set like the New York 311 data and make a call center predictor to predict call volume now that you know how to do regression. Every time he said that in the book, which was basically in every chapter at the end of all the chapters in the first one, it turned into a 5 to 8 week big graduate level computer science project for me, basically to learn it. And so the second edition of the book and what I'm writing right now is all the work that I did over 9 months, you know, at night when my wife's like, why aren't you coming to bed? I was learning machine learning with TensorFlow. And so the second edition of the book adds, probably 8 new chapters, which really fill in all the gaps, and it makes revisions on all the old chapters to fill in the gaps of, you know, I'm the sort of, you know, default type of reader in that. I came in with a statistical background, a background in search, information retrieval. I didn't know anything about machine learning 2 years ago, and now I'm writing a book on it. So yeah, anyways, I think I finished that in less than 20 minutes. So that's the abridged version. So
that's good. I think we can see what the final runtime of that is, but it was approximately five, which is great. And now you're writing this book, and we're glad you are. Now, let us begin at the beginning. How do you explain TensorFlow to a newcomer? And maybe you have only revised those chapters from first edition to second edition, but you're still the author of the second edition, so you are responsible for that. And I'm assuming I'm supposed to be able to come into this book. It's in the In Action series, and typically for a In Action Manning book, I'm making this sound like a Manning commercial. It's not a Manning commercial. It's a Chris commercial. But it's not even a Chris commercial. We're talking about the stuff you do. But typically for a Manning In Action book, you're supposed to be able to pick it up and not know much about the thing and learn. So let's just pretend I'm that person who doesn't really know much about TensorFlow and explain it to me like I'm 5. Or maybe like I'm 25 but not good at TensorFlow.
Thanks. Easy setup. Here you go, Tim. So it starts with the story of machine learning. Machine learning is learning from data, allowing the world to teach us just like we do, in real life, formatted with our biological systems and the way human beings act. And that's teaching a computer to act the same way. That's sort of the process of machine learning. So in the beginning, really quick, machine learning is things like looking at numbers and lines and fitting lines to numbers and then trying to use those lines or those curves that fit numbers to predict new values of those lines and curves. So looking at a set of data points that you plot, figuring out a best fit line and using that line to predict basically the next data point that you haven't seen yet.
Which is not a practice that has emerged in the last 5 years, for the record.
Absolutely. It's been around for a long time. We call that regression. And so basically starting out looking at the study of machine learning and understanding that, we move from that to activities like classification, where we look at a bunch of data and things that we've provided labels to about that data, things we've classified. Like I look at a set of you know, I was going to say DVDs, but you know, that would date me. So I guess Blu-ray discs. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. You know, actually, you stream things now, so
right. Yeah, I'm even more dated. So there you go. But, yeah. So anyways, if you still have Blu-ray discs and you maintain collections of them, it would be like looking at the labels or the genres or the categories for those data items. And then trying to, when looking at a new Blu-ray disc, based on your knowledge before of what genre or whatever, making a prediction about what genre it falls into based on prior knowledge. We call that classification. We also call the process, like when said, you know, if you have children, like I do, I've got three, and I've got a little beautiful 2.5-year-old daughter, my Mambacita, and she is, you know, she makes a big mess and she messes up all my Blu-rays and things like that. And then I got to put them back, you know, without the labels in front of me. And I might just intrinsically cluster things in what we call an unsupervised fashion. Maybe I'll put the Blu-rays back together and I'll organize them by genre. Maybe I'm feeling like I'll put them by the director, or maybe if I'm really anal or attentive, which I'm not saying I am, I might put them by genre and director and things like that. So we call that process unsupervised clustering, or grouping things together, because it doesn't need a label and there's some natural organization to things. I'm going to stop there. Those are some of the things that machine learning can do. And so where TensorFlow comes in is that in the past, the way that people implemented these types of capabilities and machine learning across a number of different programming languages and things is very diverse. You know, there's something called Scikit, you know, which is a very popular Python library to do it. In Java, there's things like ND4J. There's, you know, technologies like deep learning for J, you know, to build these types of, to implement machine learning. You know, like predictions using regressions or classifications or even, you know, things like that, or using new techniques like deep learning, which we haven't talked about yet. So there are all these landscape of technologies to do it. And what TensorFlow is it's Google's basically at scale version of implementing machine learning. And why is that important? Well, all of this podcast is an example of, you know, a technology that was implemented at scale, right? You know, Kafka, which initially started at LinkedIn and other places for streaming data, and then became sort of a discipline of practice, being able to apply techniques like, you know, again, Kafka, you know, streaming data, TensorFlow for machine learning at scale. Google has tons of data. You know, they do tons of unsupervised learning and grouping and categorization. Think YouTube, right? Just grouping together YouTube videos or things like that. They also, you know, do tons of classification, adding labels to things, all of these just techniques. And so the difference with Google is that they do it with 27 terabytes of data a day into YouTube. And that was years ago. So I'm sure it's more now. They do it
something higher now.
Exactly. Yeah. It's something higher. And, you know, they do it with literally billions of queries a day that people issue where they expect to get back things that have been classified. And so at that level and at that scale, machine learning is different. You can't take something like, say, Scikit, which works perfect. I love Scikit. This isn't sort of a, you know, diss on them, but it works perfect in a lone researcher mode individually on a laptop and things like that. But it's hard to scale, you know, to big data. TensorFlow is sort of Google's foray into doing that. And the reason that that's important is that Google has all of this infrastructure, just like things like Kafka and, you know, and other, you know, practical infrastructure. They're really the standard bearer. Google develops some new big data platform or technology. 2 years, 5 years later, they write a paper about it. They publish it at Operating Systems Principles. They publish it somewhere. And then the open source community says, oh, we want that. And they implement it, you know, and they implement a version, or Google open sources their version of it. And this has been sort of tried and true the story for a decade or more. With TensorFlow, what that is TensorFlow was their internal system that they'd use to do machine learning at scale, those types of predictions, classifications, and deep learning and things which we haven't talked about yet, on top of Google's infrastructure and their platform, on top of GFS, on top of MapReduce, on top of all of the things that, you know, might make sense to your listeners. Now, TensorFlow models machine learning. And one really cool thing about it that I just want to say too is that, you know, the things that we talked about, and I purposefully did this to your question, I didn't talk about implementing neural networks to start. I just talked about basic machine learning principles, which, like you said, Tim, have been around for a long time. The beauty of TensorFlow is that you're modeling graphs. So to build a classifier, for example, we need to set up a training data process. We need to take all of those Blu-ray, DVD data points and things, and then we need to take the labels for the genres and all that. And then we need to cut it. You know, we need to take 80% of that data, hold 20% out, and the 80% of the data on, the way that we build sort of a machine learning classifier is that we keep, we set up a graph. We set up what we call a model, which is really just a system of equations that say, whenever these lights are on, or these features, right, that represent the movie or the Blu-ray and things are on, you get this label. And that basically translates to, I don't know, let's say we were doing hundreds to thousands of movies, thousands of linear equations. Machine learning and classification, like tasks just like that Blu-ray DVD classification problem as a system of linear equations, just from math. Basically, like, the DVD has features. We it's got a genre. It's got perhaps some other elements about it, like a lead actor or a director. We represent those as variables in a set of linear equations. And then basically when they're turned on or off, like we assign a 1 to it if it's on or a 0 to it if it's off, that represents a label that it gets, like a genre or things like that. And if you basically just write that down, what you get is for every data point, a row in a series of a systems of linear equations. And so basically the way to model that is you could make, for instance, a set or a graph of variables that model those linear equations, that whenever we provide a set of data or these DVDs or things like that to it, it turns certain variables on or off and it gets a label. So we model that as a graph. So the beautiful thing about that with TensorFlow is that TensorFlow really is just a way to model tensors or values for those variables in a graph.
Tell me what a tensor is before you go on.
Yeah, so a tensor really is just a value or a node for a variable in a graph. So, you know, like, again, in that very simple, let's just take like, let's take 2 times by x squared plus, 1 times by x equals 4. Each variable in that, both the x value for x squared, the value for x, and as well as the x0, which if you remember, any number raised to the power of 0 is 1 from math.
One.
Exactly. Yeah. Each one of those is a tensor connected together. The first two imply the value or the label for the last value. So a tensor is some sort of placeholder, you know, that will have a value for that variable. And so that's why it's called TensorFlow, because as you look at machine learning, there's machine learning, you divide it into the process of, again, showing it examples, training, you know, here's my data set again of DVDs, you know, with labels and things like that for the genre. The DVDs have properties or features about them. And then what you do is you got to save some of the data out. We call that holding it out, because we don't want to, you know, what we call overfit the network. And we can talk about what that means later, but we got to hold some of it out so we can test it to see how well our model that we built is. So we save, 80% of the data. So if we got 200 DVDs to, or I keep saying DVDs and dating myself, Blu-ray discs, even worse.
Just say video cassettes.
Video cassettes, 8-tracks, you know, and cassette tapes.
My John Denver 8-tracks.
Exactly. And, you hold some of those out. So we're going to train on 80% of those. Basically, we model their feature by basically building a model, which is a graph in TensorFlow. And then we start showing data to that model, basically, and then giving the labels for the values that each element, each feature in the data or each tensor in the graph should represent. And we do that, we keep training it, and initially it's really bad. You know, initially what we call, and this is just basic math and statistics, the error bars are very high, because maybe after only seeing one example, you know, it thinks everything is a horror movie or things. But what you find is as you start to diversify and show it more examples, especially of different classes or different labels that you expect or that have diversity in what we call the features, right? Then the network and the error and things about that start to get less and less and less. And so the more data that you show to it, and I'm greatly oversimplifying it at this point, because there are other sort of little turning knobs that you could use. For instance, one of the knobs is how well the model predicts those labels. And the error is the difference between that. There's something in a whole discipline in machine learning that's just focused on what they call the optimization function, which is about minimizing that error. You know, and but there are a lot of off-the-shelf ones that you could just pick up. And, you know, most of the practice of machine learning nowadays, it's really in that realm. It's really in its sort of, I would call, renaissance right now, because there are so many tools to kind of optimize and put together, but there are also so many that just work right away that you can just use and start building networks and focus less on reinventing the new, you know, optimization technique and things like that. You can just pick one up off the shelf, that it's really made machine learning practical. And so back to TensorFlow, what TensorFlow allows you to do is to build a model, which is a graph of basically placeholders for data that you're going to show it, right? And as you show it data, the flow of ones and zeros through that model, and again, as they apply to predicting a label or predicting a value or doing or clustering or doing something like that, grouping things inherently, the model in TensorFlow needs to maintain state. And so that's what TensorFlow does in a very sort of optimized way. Each one of those tensors, what they basically say in a graph, each one of those tensors, those nodes in a graph that can have different values depending on whether you're training it or asking it to make a prediction for you or things like that. What Google has found out is when you want to scale that out beyond just running it locally on your laptop and things like that, you might want to deploy the X squared value for that graph to a GPU node or a particular one. Or you might want to take the values that you're going to be feeding to the, you know, X to the one to a different computer. And so TensorFlow, all the nodes in TensorFlow by default can be deployed over a big set of commodity clusters and computers and things like that, like a Google-like infrastructure, all transparently to you. So as a developer, you just focus on building the graph, building your model, right, of machine learning, a prediction, a regression, a classification, a neural network, which we could talk about what that means and stuff later.
We're about to.
Yep. And, you know, so basically you don't have to worry about where that's running and where it gets deployed. And then what Google added on top of it is they have new, because they're Google, they have new, just like Google, you know, the Linux file system wasn't good enough for Google. And there are, it's a whole podcast. I could tell you the answer about that. Don't get me into search and talking about that. But, you know, the Linux file system wasn't good enough for Google. So they made the Google file system, right? And their own custom hardware to kind of optimize that. Google also saw that you could make other optimizations for machine learning when you know a lot about the way that the graph is set up and what type of data that you're going to, you know, provide to it. So TensorFlow itself is a framework to build machine learning, run it on big commodity clusters. It also has native integration to Google's Tensor processing units, which in their mind is an evolution of GPU hardware, which are GPUs, are graphical processing units. They've been present in everybody's computer forever. It was basically the way that we played video games on it, and that the graphics.
And they're basically hardware, they're processors that are optimized for highly parallelized vector multiplication, right? You have two lists of numbers and you want to multiply them and add them up, basically is kind of the thing, right?
Totally. For systems of linear equations, for vectors, for matrices, exactly. And GPUs basically speed it up. Because as it turns out, there's tons of those types of operations in computer graphics, because they, you know, do, they've been doing ray tracing and other things, you know, forever in 3D worlds. And so basically GPUs are specialized hardware that can process that faster. So then people figured out in the machine learning community, hey, we should be using GPUs, you know, but the challenge, of course, was
they said, oh, wait, I do lots of vector multiplication, and there were GPUs.
Exactly. And so, you know, after that, you know, of course, the challenge with that is that, you know, you needed specialized software to interface with them in the computer graphics community. So there's been a whole other renaissance of making GPUs either easier to program. And TensorFlow works great with GPUs, too. It doesn't care. That's fine. It can work. It can even work well with CPUs. It's just slower, you know, by orders of magnitude. But also, TensorFlow can work with Google's tensor processing units as well. Which, you know, we don't know all about the internals of Google, and, you know, they're, you know, obviously a for-profit company. They don't reveal everything. But the theory is that, you know, TPUs are simply GPU devices or clusters or farms of them made available in cloud ways and optimized for specific types of machine learning models built using TensorFlow, you know, and things like that. So that, you know, maybe you learned a lot after running, you know, Google's YouTube ad service, you know, where you needed labels to classify videos to show ads related to them. Maybe they learned a ton, you know, about they built some, you know, classification models or deep learning models for those particular videos and ads. And maybe they learned a ton about, you know, running those types of models at scale on GPUs such that there was enough knowledge in those tensors and those models that they built that, you know, they said, hey, maybe we could optimize it in a way, or we could create specialized hardware for it. So that's what the TPUs are and all that. So yes, so TensorFlow is a framework. It doesn't need TPUs. It can run on GPUs. It can run on CPUs. It's a framework for basically building machine learning models, even more traditional ones that many people in statistics and stuff might be familiar with, as well as neural networks and things like that. And yeah, it's a framework for deploying those models, executing them at scale, lazily evaluating them. So, you know, building a model, but not having it all load into memory at once, just sort of testing and designing it, and so on and so forth. It's programmed primarily in Python. Well, the code, the underlying code is in C++, because that's what makes it fast. And it has Python bindings. It has bindings to Java, to other languages and things like that. And many, many people in the data science community use TensorFlow. In the book, I'm using it basically primarily from Python and Jupyter notebooks, which makes it really nice and, you know, easy to kind of set up. So that's my, you know, I told you my short answer. Anyways, my wife's right. I am long-winded, but that's my answer to what TensorFlow is.
She may be onto something. I think we should reserve judgment. And for being on a podcast, that's not a bad thing. You know, the opposite problem is worse. So don't you worry about that. You did mention neural networks. How are those related? I mean, you're talking about you're keeping this simple, which is good, and really speaking of this in terms of linear regression. And like, I know enough about machine learning to know that the computation that everybody spends all their time on and warms up all the GPUs in the world doing is fundamentally a regression that you're doing at some point. But this isn't, you're not fitting a linear, you know, the equation of a line, a first order polynomial to a data set. You're doing something else. So what do neural networks have to do with this?
So neural networks have existed also for a long time. They're biologically inspired, and they've been studied by the AI community, you know, for, I would say, greater than 40 years. And the Department of Defense invested in them and a lot of other places. And so what they are is basically, and I'll explain it in the context of a very popular neural network, a convolutional neural network. Biological researchers looked at the way that our visual cortex and the eye models things. And how it, when we see things in our visual cortex, certain neurons turn on and off in our brain, right? And so those things that we see, you could just think of them as images, right? So you take an image and a computer image and things like that. All it is in X and Y in two dimensions, right, are a set of pixels that have some values that are turned on or off, right? And then you could take it X, Y, and Z, right, into RGB space, in which the Z axis is the red, the green, and the blue, right? So there are three sets of points in every cell in X and Y for that. That's an image. And basically, our visual cortex sees those. And again, certain things turn on in our brain, and we say cat, or we say big screen TV, like I'm looking at right now, which I promise I'm not watching. But, you know, things like that. And so again, fundamentally, the way that our minds work is that those neurons turn on and off. And then what are they doing? They're assigning a label. They're making a prediction, you know, or I look at that image and I, you know, see the bathroom and I make a judgment 10 steps away, you know, or things like that. So that's a prediction that could be, you know, not necessarily a classification, but that's a count, that's a regression. So even in those cases, we still fundamentally use machine learning and neural networks. And so what a neural network is basically a network that takes as input data that has features. So instead of the movie example or the Blu-ray, let's just take an image like we're talking about. And I provide to it the image pixels and say those RGB intensities. So those are simply, you know, values of red, green, and blue that I see in pixel space. And what the neural network does with that particular input is we're modeling neurons. So we might want to say, I'm going to create a neural network that's 1,000 neurons. And all a neuron can do is basically take that input that we give it and basically fire or not. And so the firing or not is it has a one value or it has a zero value, because we're computer people and geeks. And so firing means one, not means zero. Everything's binary, right? And so basically the way that we use math to model or make those neurons fire or not is we're mathematicians too. We can do it. You know, we use math functions. And so there are math functions that you give data to it, and it can actually bound what we call the range of the function, which is the set of possible values, to zero and one. One of the classic examples of that is if you look at the, and this is going to be negative one to one, but you know, I'm going to give you a different example. If you look at the tangent function, I give it, you know, any continuous sequence of values in the domains, and its range is a value between negative one and one. There's a function called sigmoid, which bounds values between zero and one in terms of giving, no matter what you give it, it's going to stomp it into basically a curve or something that goes between zero and one, right? So there's a whole bunch of these magic functions that no matter what the input is in math, it's going to bound the domain to be zero and one. So when we set up our neural network, each neuron, we're giving it some function like that. We make the, you know, assumption, and this is what people are talking about when they're talking about smooth curves and gradients, you know, when they're dealing with neural networks and machine learning, is basically we give it a function that's going to create a smooth curve between zero and one to represent the neuron, one of those thousand that we talked about, firing or not. Okay. And so if it's firing, if the neuron is firing, it's just like in our brain, we're modeling that some knowledge is kind of coming out of it, you know, that something is happening, you know, associated with that. So again, in that case of like giving it an image, our model that we're actually building is just a set of neurons and they fire or not. And then what the process of deep learning there is basically modeling which neurons are firing or not. And then which neurons firing, which ones are zeros, we're back to regression or we're back to classification, imply whatever label we want to give it. So our model in a neural network is suddenly not a system of linear equations, but it's simply 1,000 nodes that whatever input you give it, we take the value that it would generate, which it could be any arbitrary function, and we apply the tangent to it or the sigmoid or whatever to force the value between zero and one.
Or some arbitrary curve that you have GPUs getting really warm computing during the training process.
Bingo. And then we take the ones and zeros out of that and they imply a label. And then that's it. And then we just keep showing it data and more data and more data. And initially there's a loss function, which just measures how well that model does versus what, you know, how well it predicts the label versus what the actual label was. And we just keep giving it more data. And what they've shown is that neural networks can model that way arbitrary functions, just arbitrary. So it's simple, right? Like, you know, I didn't tell you this is a linear function, this is a polynomial function, this is whatever. I just said, magically, if I gave you 1,000 neurons that could have a value of zero or one, independent of whatever the domain of input that we give it is, as it turns out, and then if you basically put those neurons, which what they call hidden layers, that's what a hidden layer is, in between the input and the expected output, and you just wire them together, you fully connect them, that's what a fully connected network is, or you make some other type of connections using things called dropout and other things like that, which we won't even talk about, but you just connect them together to the input and to the expected output, that network will eventually model a function. And it will, with supervision and training and things like that, reduce the loss on that function and keep reducing the loss and keep reducing the loss. And the more data that you give it, it'll converge faster. And that basically is what neural networks are. You know, that,
so
that,
there's that's a layer. Yeah. There's a frontier of neurons. Say you've got a camera, you know, 128 by 128 pixel camera. It's black and white, and you're trying to detect whether there's a cat there or not. So you have, you know, you have cat data. Those 128 by 128 pixels. So that'd be 2 to the 14th. That'd be like 16,384 neurons on that front layer. You'd have a lot of those. all those pixels feeding into it, and then their outputs feed into some a layer of some number of neurons, and then theirs and theirs and theirs for some number of hidden layers, each layer implementing that, you know, its function on the previous layer's outputs. Is that it?
Totally. And what they've said, you could even do it with one layer, Tim. You could simply have one layer if you wanted. And so this is a whole study and a whole kind of active area of research right now. And, you know, DeepMind, the biggest brains in the world at Tesla, you know, Hulk, Tony Stark, you know, all those people.
All those guys. This is Ultron level material.
This is Ultron level material. Even they don't have the answer to it. This is called neural architecture design. Like, no one can tell you, for instance, how many hidden layers should I use to do XYZ? There's a lot of best practices. There's a lot of people that are studying this. But, you know, this is the magic, too, about neural networks that's got everyone warming those GPUs up, like you're talking about. Because, you know, the real magic sort of about it there, too, is, you know, there are best practices. They can tell you. But the reality is there's a lot of flexibility. And that's why I call it the Renaissance right now, in the way that these things are being designed, you know, and the other kind of tricky, you know, thing about it, you know, too, Tim, is that basically it's, we skipped a step. So in the prior things I told you, remember I told you about the DVDs, we need to model something about their features, you know, like we need to take like a Blu-ray, a cassette tape, we need to say it's got a genre, it's got a director, it's got a whatever that implies whatever the label we want to give it to. That's called, in traditional machine learning, feature design, or the process of feature engineering. In neural networks, we didn't do that. Basically, what we did is we just gave it the data. We gave the, you know, however many n hidden, you know, n neural neuron hidden layers, we gave them all the data, and then we hooked them all up to one another, and we basically just said their values have to be 0 or 1, no matter what, and that's good. So we skipped the step of feature engineering, because to be honest, the neural network figures that out for you. So that's why people call those black box models, right? Because when you engineer your features, there's a trade-off. The trade-off is you have a lot of input into the experimental design of what you're predicting, and you can explain why the predictions are happening a lot easier. If you don't engineer your features and you just let this magical, whimsical thing figure it all out for you, which, by the way, we all know by now it does.
It really literally does.
It literally does. Then, you know, why did neuron 626,525 turn on, right? That's a harder question to answer. Can, you know, but that's why people call those black box models. And that's what's scaring the crap out of the government, commercial industries, and things like that, because they've moved so fast. It's like Jurassic Park, you know, it's like Ian Malcolm, you know, we stood on the shoulders of others and we created dinosaurs and, you know, did you earn that?
Your data scientists spent so much time figuring out if they could get the neuron to fire. They never stopped to ask whether it should.
There you go. Exactly. And so, you know, you did that well, by the way. Jeff Goldblum, you know, a friend of a friend, so let me know. You know, just like that, you know, we kind of got here. And so everyone's trying to kind of figure out how to kind of not pick up the pieces, but what we should do, because it's moved so fast, they need to be explainable now. So there are $100 million government programs. There are, you know, commensurate industry investments in really trying to make those models explainable. So
now I have two more questions. I would like you briefly to tie that whole deep learning training process back to TensorFlow. Like, what does TensorFlow do to help me do that briefly? And then I want to get to, well, give me that, and then I'll give you the next question.
Sure.
How does TensorFlow help me with that?
It'll be short, believe it or not. And you probably don't believe it after talking to me for 50 minutes.
I don't believe you.
Here you go. The way that it does that is that the neurons in those neural networks, guess what they are? They're tensors, just like the X variables in a graph in a system of linear equation. They're simply tensors. That's it. I mean, that's how TensorFlow helps you. The tensor is the X variable in a system of linear equations. It's the neuron in a set of 1,000 neurons and, you know, in layer one, and it's the neuron, you know, 500 in layer two. They're all tensors. So what TensorFlow helps you to do is have all the basically systematic programming, application programming interface, or native way of building those models using a small number of functional calls, like create a layer with, you know, 1,000 hidden neurons, make it fully connected to the next layer, blah, 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 blah. So it also has the ability to do it at the low level. So if you're doing like a regression or a classification or something like that, you may just go directly into TensorFlow, creating X variable placeholders and feeding data into that. It also has the higher level APIs. So by the time you get to dealing, you know, deep networks, and you're just, again, like, because it's an art and not a science now, and, you know, people will probably get after me for that, but it truly is in terms of neural architecture construction. And there are best practices and patterns, but again, it's people are experimenting with it. You know, TensorFlow provides you high level APIs to just add a layer with 1,000 neurons, fully connected up. Here's my, you know, loss function, pick tan, you know, for the, you know, 0 to 1 function, or pick sigmoid or whatever. All of that are just a few parameter calls and API support and things like that. That's how it helps you. So,
got it. So you made a distinction earlier on between supervised and unsupervised learning. Unsupervised learning being a thing where we can look at a data set and find, you know, for example, groups of things that we might not have known about, that we can just infer from lots of samples of the data set what those clusters are. But it seems like the interesting things are all supervised, like everything that's happening. You mentioned Tesla, and in the world of either self-driving cars or relatively more automated cars, or the Amazon Home Assistant, whose name I will not utter now so that she doesn't make noise in the background. That kind of speech recognition, you know, these are all ML-driven things. Whether those organizations are using TensorFlow in particular is an open question, but those are all supervised. It's like the cool things that are going on in machine learning right now are all supervised learning tasks, which means, to summarize, I need to train the system, you know, and it's under the covers, it's computing a regression. There's this curve it's trying to fit somewhere, whether it's in a neuron or a simpler system in there, but there's a curve fitting process it's trying to do, training a system against labeled data. Like I'm saying, these are pictures of cats. There's the fun meme-ish thing that comes through sometimes, you know, pug or blueberry muffin. It's a bunch of pictures of pugs up close and blueberry muffins up close, and you're not sure, and you know, so, you know, it'd be good ML test data, but you have to train the thing by showing it lots of pictures of pugs, and making sure it really knows what a pug looks like, so that when you show it a picture of a blueberry muffin, it knows it's not a blueberry muffin. So there's this training thing, right? And if I may, it seems like, and I'm talking about making GPUs warm. The warming up of the GPUs, really the energy consumption in ML, is during training. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It's the energy consumption is there. And I mean, predictions, depending on the size. So, you know, the output of training is a model, right? It's a model in which the weights or the values for those variables or tensors have been set to something, right? That got you the smallest loss or the best prediction. That really is a model. So imagine in that case, you build a big hidden network, or I'm sorry, you build a big neural network with dozens of hidden layers, thousands of neurons apiece, right? And so the weights or the model that you've built, the result of that before training is not very big, right? It's big, but it's just placeholders for 1,000 things that you, or for, I'm sorry, hundreds of thousands or million things that you haven't filled, which we call parameters. And then after training, you've filled it. Right? You've found the particular weights and the values that got you the smallest loss or the smallest difference between your prediction and the actual value. And so during training, you do warm those GPUs. Now, when you make a prediction, depending on the size of your architecture or your neural architecture and what those weight values were, whether they were floating point or whatever, you may be loading into memory a 20 gigabyte model, right? But the process of then feeding it or showing it one new data item or n new data items, and then having it apply all those weights to basically tell you your label is this or whatever, that's fast. Yeah, that's much faster. Yeah. That's exponentially faster.
Good. And that's good in that. That's what I thought. So the thing about that is, and here we are, we're at about 45 minutes into the episode, which is normally where we end, but here we are. We're getting to the streaming thing. Training is normally a batch process. It's like so normally a batch process. I think without examining the question, a lot of ML practitioners right now, developers who are working in that area full time, just assume it's a batch process. Here's my pile of training data, and I update it, and you know, I pay attention to model drift and all that stuff. It's not like it's just I do it once and one and done, but I do a thing called training my model that's computationally expensive, and then my operationalized model runs and it makes predictions, and everybody loves me. But that training is a thing that we do with a pile of labeled data. Even if that is updated weekly and we do it again, it's like financial reporting used to be, or ETL used to be. It you know, nightly would probably be impressive for training. So where this intersects with Kafka and what I see coming up more than I'd expect is this kind of intersection. And most of the Kafka machine learning discussion that's going on right now is about operationalized models. There was some training process, and like we've got some neat demos on the Confluent blog. We've got a guy who's been on the podcast. He's a solutions engineer at Confluent. His name is Kai Vayner. That's the American pronunciation. Kai Vayner.
Don't even make me do the Southern California one. It will
German. I'd love to do that. German is non-rhotic. This is a thing that I think most English speakers don't really realize, but you don't pronounce the R at the end. So anyway, Kai is a big fan of various ML things, and he wrote some sample code that had an H2O model in Java that runs, and it runs, you know, when Kafka consumes an event, it processes the event through the model and makes a prediction. And like nobody gets hurt there. That's just fairly understandable if you sort of know what Kafka is. And once you know what machine learning is, obviously models are going to pop up in your consumers and in your Kafka Streams applications and your KSQL user-defined functions. And that all makes sense to the point where it's, you know, in this case, I think not worth asking about. You could put an operationalized model in a consumer and do it on an event-by-event basis and make predictions and win friends and influence people. But how about what I want to get to is real-time retraining. So there's the training process, but can I do that in an event stream? Can I do that on a message-by-message basis? What are people doing? How does it work?
Totally. Yeah, you totally can do it. And I'm not going to tell you everything about it because I want you to invite me back on your podcast again, because I want to take like literally 47 and a half minutes just getting there again and telling, and then we'll just kind of keep it on loop and repeat.
Perfect.
You know, so you'll keep having to have me on, but here, yeah.
Perfect.
Yes, absolutely. Here's something just to wet the whistle. We're working on a big program in cyber defense, basically fighting phishing right now. And I basically told my team, even long before I met you, Tim, and long after I was on the Apache board and, you know, was more involved in all these, you know, things like Kafka and all that. But I told them in this cyber phishing program that has many different vectors and ways that we're, you know, trying to defend against attacks. The idea is from an SMS text, from an email, from a LinkedIn invite, people are getting phished and it sucks. And we need better ways of sort of detecting that. So we're using machine learning to first classify what the phish type is. Is it like trying to get your credentials? Is it, you know, trying to get you to send money to somebody in Nigeria? You know, those types of things. So we have a machine learning process that, you know, trains and basically understands that. And then we use that to basically empower intelligent digital assistants that really are there to defend you in your email box, at the last mile, upstream in a black box product, you know, that you could put in your network or, you know, in your phone as an app, you know, and things like that. And so the idea is, you know, there in those intelligent digital assistants, the way that we're actually running our evaluations and that we're testing them and stuff like that is that we have a big Kafka pipeline set up. And basically what we do is we replay our attacks. You know, like we basically collect a bunch of attacks from all those different vectors and we replay them through Kafka queues to standardize on the way that all the people, the dozens of institutions participating in this program, to standardize on the way that they write their software to do that both detection, so the consumption part, and to also standardize on the way that their softwares, which will eventually become commercial products, transition to the government, whatever, other areas in academia, how they respond. How their intelligent digital assistants respond. And so just to let you know, that project is actually very successful. We're big fans of, you know, how Kafka is supporting us in that. And there are two machine learning elements to it too. There is a training element, you know, during that. And we are doing what I'll call event-based, you know, real-time training, you know, as during those replayed attacks to basically improve machine learning models. And we are using things like TensorFlow to do that. In particular, you know, we've got a couple of classification models to assign a label to the type of attack, what the ask is, you know, and things like that. And then secondly, those intelligent digital assistants, whereas it's not streaming, you know, on prediction, on training, they do have to make predictions and apply them and then send messages back in various ways through Kafka queues. And so they're doing that. So that's your basic thing. And you can have the 50-minute version, you know, if you invite me back. So
okay, about real-time retraining.
Yep.
Okay. I think that sounds like a plan, because that is, like I said, an operationalized model that runs on an event-by-event basis in a consumer, whatever form that consumer takes, you know, streams, native API or KSQL or whatever, it's a consumer, is great and a killer application of machine learning in an event streaming system. But I don't feel like that's the money. I feel like, you know, duh, of course somebody was going to do that. It's done. It takes you the afternoon and well, you know, apart from building the model and all that, but you know, the Kafka integration is trivial. And I want to know about the real-time retraining. I think that is, that's where the money is here, where we can have models that, the analogy is to ETL, you know, ETL used to be nightly and suddenly that wasn't good enough. And now it's messagely, you know, it's latency measured in milliseconds or hundreds of milliseconds or small numbers of seconds. And I think with model training, I think we need to get to that same place.
I totally agree. And actually, let me also put another, you know, plug in for our next discussion, because think about that in an interplanetary fashion. We are doing training now with human in the loop, HITL, with Mars rovers, with future rovers who have the ability to run predictions on board, which they don't currently do. It's all human in loop. And you want to talk latency bandwidth. How do we do interplanetary Kafka? There you go.
My guest today has been Chris Mattman. Chris, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thanks so much for having me, Tim. It's been awesome.
And there you have it. If you're still listening, you get a special discount code for sticking with us all the way to the end. You can use the code PODCON19, that's PODCON19, to get 40% off all Manning publications in all formats. Just enter PODCON19 during checkout on Manning.com, and that 40% off is all yours. Enjoy it. And I hope this podcast was helpful to you. And if you want to discuss it more or ask a question, you can always reach out to me on Twitter at TL Berglund. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out to us in community Slack. There's a Slack signup link in the show notes if you'd like to join that group. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. If you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which we think is a good thing. Thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.